Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
There we go.
All right. Hey, everyone. No, I'm just
stop doing that. You always do that. And then it's so awkward editing the beginning of the episode. Like, how do we get into this episode? Do we keep Kara or do we delete Kara and pretend that it never happened?
I say we keep all of this and it's a perfect start to the episode. And hey, everyone, this is Afterlives with Ancient Egypt. And I am your host, Kara. And today I'm going to be hanging with my sidekick, Amber Myers-Wells. And we will be talking. Yeah, sorry. We will be talking about what, Amber? What are we talking about?
Well, we're going to be talking about Thutmose III and the veneration of ancestors, specifically within the context of the late 20th dynasty and 21st dynasty.
Okay.
Which you know a little bit about.
I've been thinking about this a lot with the publication of my, almost publication of my latest book, Recycling for Death, in which the coffins of venerated ancestor kings are published extensively. And that the reason I started thinking about this treatment of ancestor kings is because those coffins, particularly the coffins made for kings, like the coffin in which Sekenenre Tau is reburied, the coffin in which Thutmose III is reburied, they all show a lot of manipulation over generations. Like, it's obvious that they're like sawing it open and then they're taking stuff out and then they're redoing it. And then they put the king back in and then they reconsecrate it. And then they saw, and then like a couple generations go by or less and they saw it back open and they take some more shit and then reconsecrate in some way. And to see all of that action over like a 250 year time span is really interesting. And so it made me think of ancestor veneration, how power is built using the past and the dead. And so it's something I presented on at the International Congress of Egyptologists in Leiden. It's something I'll present about at the Coffins in Context conference at Cambridge in February of 2024. And yeah, it's on the brain.
You're talking about them getting into these coffins of royal ancestors and reusing them in some ways, manipulating them, as you say. And I know growing up, learning about ancient Egypt, when they talk about these royal caches, as Egyptologists call them, sort of the narrative was, or I guess to a certain extent is, that the ancient Egyptians, they reached a certain point in their history and they realized that all of these tombs of past kings are subject to people entering them, stealing things, that there's thievery happening in the Valley
thievery,
of Kings.
Robbery.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. And
yeah, it's set up that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And that these later ancient Egyptians, they want to help protect the bodies of these royal ancestors. And so Egyptologists looked at these caches and they saw protection. They're bringing them all together. They want to keep them from being further disrupted or desecrated or whatever. So we're going to put them together in these little caches with a new protection for them. And just as you were talking, I was thinking, I was like, once again, an example, I think, of Egyptologists buying the narrative that those Egyptians who did the caching of all these royal ancestors wanted you to think that, yes, of course, they're bringing them together. They're protecting them from being disturbed and they're gathering them together to honor them and to keep them safe.
Yeah. So the narrative has only been rewritten in the last 20 years, and let names of the Egyptologists who have helped rewrite this. And if you're studying or you want to Google some of this at home, get on your Wikipedia or whatever, look at the tomb, Theban tomb 320. That's the so-called royal cache. It's also called Deir el-Bahri 320. And there you've got kings like Ramses II, Thutmose III, Thutmose I, and I could go on. And then there's another cache that's in Kings Valley tomb 35, the tomb of Amenhotep II. And there you have kings like Amenhotep III, and Thutmose IV and others. And these are very complicated and messy affairs to study as archaeologists. But the story is, as you say, that there's a whole bunch of thievery and tomb robbery and bad people came in and just laid waste to the Valley of the Kings. And it was horrible. And then these high priests of Amen came in and piously put things to right. They rewrapped the bodies after they had been ripped apart, and they re-coffined them and re-consecrated them. Well, a quick look at the coffins themselves gives you the idea that this is not the case. Oh, I was going to mention Egyptologists. So those Egyptologists who helped you rewrite this are like Carl Janssen Vinkeln, John Taylor, Nicholas Reeves. Those are the three that are popping to my head right now. There are others. And so I'm standing on their shoulders and saying, oh, yeah, this the high priests of Amun are not, you know, coming in after a big robbery and saying, oh, my God, what have you guys done here? Let's fix this. They're actually part of the recommodification of the taking of the royal treasures themselves. And you know how I always like to use analogies. And here's a good analogy that our American audience in particular, I think, would understand. So think of the murder of George Floyd in 2020 and how people responded with riots. And those riots, at least in Los Angeles, but I know in other American cities as well, would often, not always, but would often go to a mall or a shopping center of some kind where there might be a Nike store or something like that, highly sought after, very expensive, something that minority urban poor do not have access to. And that shop would be broken into and all these things would be taken. And people were freaking out. And they're like, how, this is in 2020 America, how dare they? And get the police out there and they're stealing what is not theirs. While at the same time, we don't talk about and we sacralize and consecrate and veil the thievery of white collar tech finance bros who use all kinds of legal and sometimes illegal, but means to pull extraordinary amounts of wealth to themselves such that no one else can do it. And it's an extraordinary thing that it's only recently that, and maybe since 2008, where you saw a lot of finance guys stealing money or creating extraordinary schemes to get massive amounts of money, losing their shirts in the financial crisis of 2008 in the United States, and then nothing happened to them. Absolutely nothing, except for maybe some people at a couple of firms like Lehman Brothers and such. I think it's Lehman Brothers. And otherwise, everyone getting off scot-free, no one going to jail. But all of those people, if they're arrested in a riot in a Nike store, they're going to jail, and they're going to jail for a long period of time. And they're held up as this symbol of what is wrong with society. And these are the thieves. When what these people are stealing is the tiniest of tiny fractions of a fraction of a fraction of what is being stolen by the people at the very top, who are doing it in a way such that you can't even see it or recognize it.
So, and So what you're saying is that, yes, there may have been some relatively low grade robbery happening with these tombs by, let's say, enterprising ancient Egyptians, but that paled in comparison to what the high priest of Amun was doing, that they were coming in and they were almost industrializing it. Is that what you're trying to say?
That's indeed what I'm trying to say. And we have these texts that are putting us off the trail, so to speak, forcing us to believe the story that the king in the late 20th dynasty or the high priest of Amun or high priest of Amun slash king wants you to believe. And that is that there was this robbery, and we have texts about it. We have the tomb robbery papyri dating to Ramses the Ninth. And it is only the ninth, right? This is where sometimes
I think you're right.
My brain is good.
Obviously,
But
I think you're right. Yeah.
My brain has, you know, we all have our skills. And sometimes my brain just, it's like absolute dates. I'm like, nope. And sometimes particular reigns, particularly for something that goes on for a long period of time. So that in my mind, I know these tomb robberies were happening over a long period of time, but we only have them documented for a limited period of time. But my brain doesn't always want to hold on to that. But anyway, so we have these tomb robbery papyri that document that there were investigations, there were interrogations, that they brought these robbers out into the public eye and they interrogated them. And those men were forced to name names. And they got all of this put to right by finding out who the bad guys were, sealing the tombs back up, saying, oh, nothing bad to see here. We've got it all figured out. And it's only recently that a closer reading of a text like that makes you realize that the officials at the top, whether it be a butler of the king, just like a king's man, if you like. He's not a butler like answering the door. He's a butler like sent out by the king to do for him what the king needs, or a mayor of Western Thebes, or a mayor of Eastern Thebes, or people connected to the high priest of Amun. All of these guys are kind of circling around each other, kind of subtly accusing each other by accusing men under their employ. And if you look at it that way as a system of patronage, where you're like, okay, who is this man who is being accused, interrogated, beaten, and forced to name names? Who is he working for? Because that's who is then on trial in the tomb robbery papyri being subtly accused by other officials. And if you look at it from that perspective, then you realize that in Dynasty 20, these Valley of the Kings treasures are already being exploited, these royal treasures, by high officials. But they're, you know, they're, nobody writes down on an ostracon or on papyrus, we're opening the tomb of King so-and-so today to steal some good shit. They're not going to do that. And so you have to really put your detective hat on and work carefully with the information at hand to try to understand what's going on.
Right. And then the caches were, they happened later. And so in a way that creates a different kind of documentation of the activity, whereas there aren't earlier caches like that, right?
No. And, you know, all these caches are late 20th into early 22nd dynasty, and they preserve all kinds of actions over time on them. So you'll get coffins like the coffin of Ramses in, I should say, it's not the coffin of Ramses II because it's a late Amarna, post-Amarna coffin, but the coffin in which Ramses II was reburied has multiple dockets on it. One is erased and a new one was written on. And you can tell that coffin of Ramses II has been manipulated. It's been shaved down on the exterior such that there's a hanging mortise on the edge of it. So you know that these royal coffins were pulled out of their tombs. They were exploited. Gold sheeting was removed. Other things were taken off. And then they were cleaned up, so to speak, and then reused to rebury kings, maybe not the kings who originally belonged in them, but a king. And the like a coffin like Ramses II or Thutmose III or Second Henry Tau, these are all coffins that have Nemes headdresses on them. They were made for kings. And you can see that they were open and closed multiple times or modified multiple times. And it brings up this idea that the Egyptians at the end of the 20th dynasty, early 21st, were using these kings as instruments in some way, which is really cool. You know, did they display them? Did they bring them into temples?
Well, and this is, you know, this is the heart of the matter. The question of, first of all, who were these high priests of Amun and what was their interest in reusing these royal coffins and caching these royal ancestors?
Yeah, the high priest of Amun is a really cool and interesting position, and it brings you into the Theban world like nothing else. So, you know, Egypt is a complicated place. It's a river carving through the northeastern African desert with a delta at the end of it. And you have these cities that are important. You have Memphis and Heliopolis to the north at the apex of the Nile River moving into the delta. You have the capital of Per Ramses in the northeastern delta. And you have the city of Thebes nestled down south at the Cana Bend in a very protected place that's far from the madding crowd, far from all of the craziness of the Bronze Age collapse, far from the Sea People's invasions by sea, maybe closer to some of the Libyan invasions from the West. But, you know, everyone in Egypt is having to deal with that. And in Thebes, for generations, but especially as the late Bronze Age collapse is ramping up, the institution of the god Amun was everything. So the 20th dynasty sees the murder of a king, Ramses III, in Thebes by his own harem and or servants. And there is a deep distrust, you can see, between North and South, potentially. And there's very different systems working between North and South. The king's main palace is at Per Ramses in the northeastern delta. It seems that after the murder of Ramses III, the kings go back there. and don't visit Thebes a lot. They're not building a lot. They still build their tombs down there in the Valley of the Kings, which is weird and a point I know we'll return to. But Thebes becomes more and more this domain of the high priesthood. It is run by the high priesthood. This institution is the main employer. It's where the treasury is, where the jobs are. It's where the elites dwell. And the high priest of Amun becomes de facto ruler of the south. And so that position means, it means everything. And it's the person that's, and his people, the high priest of Amun and all of his lieutenants, all of his under priests and wab priests and guardians and craftsmen in his employ, they're going to be the ones moving into the necropolis to pull wealth out of the necropolis, whether it be royal or elite, such that it can serve them. And the tomb robbery papyri of the late Ramesside period prove that other elites from the north are like, what the hell? You know, or even the mayor of Eastern Thebes, who's like, wait, why are you Western guys getting all of the good shit? What the hell? Give us some of this. What is going on? And so people descend and they're like, what are you doing? What are you doing down here? And the high priest of Amun and his guys, they're very, his guys, I'm going to keep it that broad for now, they're very good at obfuscating everything they do through religion. We know, we see this around us too. And so you have this kind of veiled economy of recommodification in Thebes that's happening through temple structures, temple institutions, and it's complicated.
So as you've pointed out, Bronze Age collapse, a time of scarcity, a little bit of political tension in the north and south of
Egypt. Little bit.
A little bit.
I mean, there will be a full civil war at the end of the 20th dynasty between north and south, southern factions.
Right.
But yeah, go ahead.
So kind of a tumultuous time period. And you've addressed the practical side of why they're going into these burials and taking advantage of, as you say, the good shit.
Yeah.
But then what's their ideological reason? Because you just mentioned this ideologically veiled sort of reasoning.
There's ideological reasoning when ever anybody rich takes from somebody else. So let's start with another analogy and then we'll jump into the ancient world. But like, think of how politicians set themselves up, or a rich person sets himself up as a jobs creator, right? Today in the toxic individualist United States of America of 2024, that they'll be like, I'm creating jobs. So, you know, I may have $300 billion, but I'm able to give all of these jobs to all of these other people without saying that the jobs that they pay can't allow people to pay for rent that's been jacked up by private equity that they're also benefiting from. But they set themselves up as somebody who is a patron of society, who is doing good for society. There's no religion involved in that one. But in the same America of 2024, you could find somebody who says, I am rich because God made me rich, and use a prosperity gospel to say that God blessed me, and use a white supremacist Judeo-Christian doctrine in which the quiet part can be said out loud, that I have more money because I am more pious and God loves me more than he loves you. And there's all kinds of systems in the United States based around that kind of inequality. And there's topics of predestination and from Calvinist religion. I mean, it's really interesting, right? But we won't go into that. But from the Egyptian perspective, you've got the people who are recommodifying, and I like to use the word recommodifying kind of for everybody, because we talk about theft, and theft is generally only assigned for those of lower status groups, whereas recycling and recommodifying get to be assigned to the higher status groups. Well, let's just say that everyone's reusing and recommodifying, and that we have a system in which rich ruling people to maintain their power would display and show a whole shit ton of awesome golden things and then stick it in a hole in the ground and say, nope, but hands off, don't touch, right? This is how powerful I am. So, you know, with all that stuff that's there in the ground and having been put in the ground and consecrated by these priests for generations, what better group of people to be able to take them out of the ground in a proper fashion, in a religiously sacralized and justified way, than the high priesthood of Amun? And that does seem to be what the royal cache, Diarbakir 320, reveals, what the dockets on the coffins of Ramses II and other kings reveal, and what a whole bunch of guys working in this economy reveal. And then the religion stuff, it can go even further than that.
Well, in your ICE presentation that you mentioned earlier and in this article that you're currently working on, you also bring up who are these high priests of Amun, right? And you talk about their identity and their interests in these royal ancestors as a way of connecting them to this history, this legacy of kingship in ancient Egypt.
Yeah. So the high priests of Amun and who they were in the 20th dynasty, they're a very important family, and they passed down their priesthood, this very important position, through a family lineage, like a royal dynasty. So you have Ramses IX and Amenhotep and another, you have other lineages, but this lineage of high priesthood is something that is broken at the end of the 20th dynasty. And there's discussions of high priests going rogue. I think essentially what happens, I'll keep the story simple because it's complicated, and this is part of the civil war that we're talking about between North and South. But it seems that Ramses XI, let me start with Ramses IX really fast. Ramses IX is shown on equal footing with the high priest Amenhotep. Amenhotep is as tall as King Ramses IX in Karnak Temple, which is extraordinary. That's something you don't see. It shows that the position of high priest has been aggrandized to such an extent that he can order his craftsmen to cut his figure at the same level, maybe not wearing the same crowns and with the same level of initiation, but he's there as a king's equal in the depiction. And that's pretty crazy. So we see that. And now Ramses IX, and this is according to people like Aidan Dodson, who've done really good historical work on this time period, who have said that Ramses IX is ruling partially concurrently with Ramses XI. Ramses IX would then maybe be a southern king. And he does seem to be beloved by the Thebans. He's the only late Ramesside body that's in Deir el-Bahari 320, which is interesting. But Ramses XI comes along. Where he comes from, don't know. Ramesside family is a big clusterfuck at this point. And who knows which cousin or of whom or which, how he finds his lineage to Ramses III or fourth or sixth or whatever. It's complicated and there's disagreement there. But Ramses XI comes on and he takes up power in the north and rules concurrent to Ramses IX. And he's got another way of taking power, which is not through religion, but through military force. And at this time period of the late Bronze collapse, how are you going to get good military dudes, but hire the mercenaries who have invaded your country en masse and have settled down over generations? And you have these big cities of migrants who've come to Egypt in the hundreds of thousands, one has to imagine. And they're calling themselves all these different sea people's names. And there's one group, whether the Meshwesh are actually sea peoples or not, can be debated. And we're not going to get into that here. But the Meshwesh are associated with the west of Egypt, with Libyan lands. And they become a real favored mercenary group. And it seems that Ramses XI is like, for whatever reason, when societies diminish and find their end and find diminishing returns, the systems start to fail. Immigrants are a thing that can keep them going longer. Interesting analogy for the United States, I dare say, right? Where even with an illegal immigrant system, it's like one of the only things that's keeping our economy going, which is a hugely problematic thing. But anyway, so there are all these immigrants there who seem to be better choices than the native Egyptians who are related to Ramses XI. Ostensibly, there are some young men in the palace who could serve as army leaders, but they don't seem to be satisfactory. He needs some different kinds of men, some new men. And so you get this guy whose name is Pa Yank. A lot of the writing vocalizes his name and makes it Pyank. And that's fine with an I, Pyank. But I, you know, it's written Pa Yank, so that's the way I write it in my text now, though I think older articles I wrote Pyank. But And it's probably, the pronunciation was probably more similar to Pyonk, but it's fine. The dude's name means like the live one, the one who is alive, or the citizen, if you like, which is a great name because it's like, he's the one who's a free man rather than an enslaved foreign immigrant dude. He's not a live captive who's been enslaved. He's a free man. And Ramses XI works with this guy, Pyonk, a warlord, makes him a general. And he works with another guy named Harry Hor. Horus is upon high. Both of these are associated with the Meshwesh, we think. And both of them become generals. And both of them get sent down to the south. And both of them end up becoming high priest of Amun. So you've got these immigrants, sea peoples, Libyan, whatever, dudes. And how long have they been in Egypt? We don't know. Some generations. Harry Hor and Pyonk, they both have Egyptian names. They're weird Egyptian names, but they're Egyptian. And then it's a way of breaking the family, the old family that ran the high priest of Amun and Thebes, infiltrating it. But then what Ramses XI maybe doesn't suspect is that they're going to turn on him too and start taking all of the power. They wait until he's dead to really take it, but they claim
right.
it nonetheless.
So
and then when he's gone, there's no lineage for him. They're asked it.
Yeah. So this hereditary kingship begins to fade, and these powerful warlords, as you call them, step into power using as a vehicle this high priesthood of Amun office, right? And
yeah.
It comes to then essentially rival the kingship, or to it elevates itself to the level of kingship.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be like, I mean, I guess the other analogy would be like the Swiss Guard. And the Swiss obviously were considered in a medieval time to be excellent mercenaries. So they're hired by the Pope in the Vatican to keep him safe. And so he's surrounding himself with Swiss guards, or one of them.
And then the Swiss Guard takes over.
Yeah, takes over, kills the Pope, or moves him to the side, and then he becomes the Pope and is sacralized in ritual as the Pope. It would be that kind of a
I think
a
you've
thing.
Just plotted out the next Dan Brown novel.
It sounds interesting to me. But, you know, it's a way of taking somebody who's completely unsuited for a position, has not been educated for it, has not been born to it, and it shows you that the military might is an essential part of getting to power in Egypt at this time of great upheaval. And yet once you get to Thebes, where all the good shit is, then you've got to sacralize it. You have to do it in a different way. So even these generals have to become something completely different, something that they probably never expected. And yeah.
Well, it's not unlike.
It's interesting.
I mean, this is a loose comparison, obviously, but it's not unlike Alexander the Great coming into Egypt and then identifying with Egyptian religion, putting himself in the guise of Amun. Ultimately, he declares himself a god.
Yeah.
And so this high priesthood of Amun.
And needs that religion to take Egypt.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So the high priesthood of Amun, they need these ancestors to plug them in to that identity and to, as you say, consecrate it and give it that veneer of divine approval or divine blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have to be the caretakers, not the violent appropriators. They're the guys taking care. It's very different from something like ancient Rome, where the Praetorian Guard can kill the emperor and become emperor. But he doesn't then become the Pope. There isn't a Pope then, but there can be in later Rome. But like, he doesn't then become, he becomes Caesar Augustus. Okay, fine, goes through an initiation. But the violence is what gets you to the top. And then it keeps you there, right? Whereas in Egypt, the violence can get you close, but it doesn't get you to the top. To get to the top, you have to go through all kinds of religious machinations and become something else. And so you're then talking about what was your last question though, when you were talking about the royal, you were talking about being caretakers and such.
Oh yeah. They have to plug into that legacy and get the divine approval or divine blessing, something mm-hmm. that shores them up ideologically.
Yeah. Because they're outsiders. A lot of their children, Harry Hor will have a child named Masaharta. He will openly name him Masaharta. And that's weird Libyan style name. So they're of foreign origin. They're not of an old Theban family. The elites are probably like, who the hell are these guys? And they've just moved their family of high priests out of the way. They now have to win hearts and minds. They have to tread very carefully and try to please those elites who are left and become initiated, take on priestly names, do things right, not fire the whole group. It's an interesting thing that power, when it lasts, must hide itself. It must hide itself from the people over whom it is powerful and present it as something else. It's why ideology is so very important to power systems.
Right. That's exactly what I was just thinking. As you were saying earlier, the violence gets them there. It gets them to the top. But if they want to hold that King of the Hill position, they have to bolster themselves with ideology. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the same in our world today, such that if you have a lot of power, say you're a Saudi prince and you're pulling in mega OPEC bucks and if you use it all on yourself and we're just like, here's my gazillion private jets and my yacht that's bigger than anything, then people would lose their minds. But if you use it to help rebuild Mecca and Medina and put yourself into that ideological religious stream as a caretaker, not as a prophet or even as an imam, but as a patron and as a caretaker, then you're able to keep your cash in the eyes of your population in a better way. And people aren't going to fight you and be like, oh my God, this is horrible. So these guys, they're actually working and they infiltrate in all kinds of ways because Harry Hoare and Pai Yonk were both working as generals before they got this position as high priest and were working as agents of the high priests who are in power in Thebes themselves and would write something on a docket. They're there as an agent. And then they end up taking the whole game themselves, at least the Theban game of high priesthood. And that's what Pai Yonk does. And then he names Harry Hoare his general. And then Harry Hoare is then going in and taking all of these bodies out of the tombs and re-commodifying the Valley of the Kings to fund their regime. But when they do it, Pai Yonk is now there as high priest saying, okay, we got to do it right. And is almost certainly relying on the high priest with more knowledge, institutional knowledge, religious knowledge to be like, okay, what kind of spells do we need to make it so the kings are happy? How do we turn the kings to our favor rather than make them angry against us as we're opening up all of their tombs? How do we use this situation to our benefit? And this is a true example of crisis being made into an opportunity.
Right. And so they begin, as you say, they cash these royal coffins and such, meanwhile, under the table, recommodifying them. But then they also begin to venerate, right, these ancestors and ultimately, in a way, begin to negotiate their politics through these venerated ancestors, the cults of these venerated ancestors and the oracles then of the divine. So can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think that's one of the coolest aspects of this.
It is super cool. And it has a long runway. And so I have to go back to the cult of Amenhotep I, who seems to, and his mother, Afma's Nefertari, both of whose bodies are found in the royal cache, their cult of veneration and an oracle dedicated to them started in the 19th dynasty at Deir el-Medina, at a point when we don't think there was a recommodification process in the Valley of the Kings going on in earnest. There was a civil war at the end of the 19th dynasty. I don't know what kind of shit went down in the Valley of the Kings. No one's going to write that down for us. There are some suggestive Deir el-Medina texts that indicate that some of the tombs were maybe opened or treated in a way that they shouldn't have been, like Paneb. Discussion sitting on the sarcophagus, etc. But we don't really know. Let's not try to say that there's recommodification happening in the 19th dynasty, but there is ancestor veneration. So the Deir el-Medina workmen are like, they're like, the reason we have our livelihood, the reason we have our jobs is because of the king. And the first king who gave us this job in their ideological schema is Amenhotep I. and Amenhotep I and his mother, Osmosnefertari, are worshipped as an Amun-Re-like divinity in their village. He's a god of everything. He's a god of help heal me. He's a god of I need more money. But he's very much a god of real political goings on. So you mentioned the oracle. And there's all kinds of information from this village of Deir al-Medina that show they would bring the god out. They would carry him aloft in his carrying chair, an image, a figurine of the god from his temple space. And they would carry him aloft and they would ask the god questions. And the men, the workmen who were elevated to his priests in this moment, who were carrying him aloft, would then move in a certain way, maybe nodding their head for a yes or shaking around for a no. They would give yes or no questions. Sometimes, strangely, there's like actual answers given. How that happens, we don't know. Did somebody like get super drunk or high and then channel Amenhotep I or something? Not clear. But we have these venerated ancestor king and queen held aloft to be a release valve for a village when it's under stress, when people are in disagreement and they don't know what to do next. It's like, well, let's let Amenhotep I take the wheel.
So an authority that everyone can agree on and accept, and everyone has the same amount of respect or desire to comply with whatever this authority says.
And, you know, I like to believe that there's always going to be different factions in any village or any town. And I like to believe that whoever is holding the bark is going, they'll hear the question, right? I mean, how do you think it works?
Okay, so first of all, I have to say, you have to read The Last Camel Died at Noon by Elizabeth Peters, because there is a whole scene directly related to this type of thing. And she puts out, I think, her idea, her scenario of it. But just generally speaking, yeah, you can see the political struggles. It's like, okay, whoops, your guys who were supposed to carry the bark, they're not here, or they have headaches, like they're sick, they're out today. My guys are here, they'll carry the bark, that's fine. You know, and it's like, okay, the bark was going to say yes, but now it's going to say no because my guys are carrying it instead of that guy's over there. So there's all sorts of possibilities here. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever know the real answer, but there's some intriguing possibilities for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you stocked it with like an equal group of guys, half on one side and half on the other, does it become a tug of war and you just have to not drop the bark?
Maybe. I don't know. Is it whoever has the most power is the guy that has the most people within those positions, right? I don't know how honest the process is. Let's just say that.
I think it's time for some experimental archaeology and we hold something heavy aloft on our shoulders and then try to get it to do things. I bet that if you're not in agreement as a group of handlers, it's going to shake about and it's going to look messy, and that's a no. So I think that if there's even a little dissent in that group, it's going to move about in a way that's not good. But so if there's a lot of agreement, then you'll get a nice clear sort of answer. And I do think that's kind of the way it worked. But
Or are these people carrying the bark or associated with the bark? Are they consuming something before these rituals or ceremonies? You know, basically getting themselves into a state in which they would believe they would be more open to receiving these divine messages. So there's drugs were involved in some way. I mean, like I said, this is fascinating stuff, but I don't know that we'll ever have a real answer on this. But I think that your overall point is that these ancestor cults have a long tradition in Egypt by the time that the high priesthood of Amun comes along and begins using them to help shore up and bolster their power and essentially their move into the kingship.
Yeah. And while you have this ancestor cult of Amenhotep I at Deir al-Medina, you have the cult of Amun and the oracle of Amun in eastern Thebes at Karnak. So, and Mut and Khonsu, there's oracles for all of them. But the conclusion is that in this time of discord, we are leaving behind decision-making in an ad hoc way, where one dude is like, we make it so. And everyone's like, yes, sir. Into a communal, ideologically veiled system of decision-making in which people come into power And they have to say, oh, no, but I'm not going to just order you around. I'm not going to just tell you what to do. I'm going to let the gods tell me what to do. And that's the way it's going to be. And so everyone's veiling their outright power, and they're using divinities and ancestor cults to do it. So, yeah. And well, that brings us, I guess, back to the 20th dynasty and all of that. Yeah.
And a brief time out there, because honestly, like in the way that you describe it, it's not that different from the current American political system.
Yeah.
But you replace the god or the oracle with the people, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And because we, I think, have reached a point where we realize that the voter doesn't have as much power as these people who are, quote unquote, voted into the office would like us to believe.
Yeah.
And that these other powers and the interests of the politicians themselves are what are the real driving forces under this. But it must be presented publicly as the will of the voter, or I'm helping my constituents. I have their interests in mind. This is a different ideological lens.
Yeah. And I've written about this at more length in The Good Kings, about how we sacralize the very notion of democracy, that we ideologize it to such an extent that voting itself is a sacred ritual act that must be protected. And your red state saying that only certain people can vote, and blue states, we must open it up to everyone in an EDI beautiful system of perfection. But the act of voting is a very small part of what's actually going on. And the lobbyists that nobody really talks about are the ones who are getting their votes.
So in ancient Egypt, we can imagine that it's a similar thing of this complicated mix of different interests and people at different levels of power vying for influence, and that they're all intermixing in complex ways that it's hard for us to really get at now, but that we can see the broad strokes of through these ancestor cults and the actions, the recorded actions that we have in the archaeological record of these kings, like Harry Hoare.
I would say that the similarity between our political scheme and the ancient 20th dynasty Theban political scheme is that you use the ideology to gain access. And the ideology gets you to the people at the top. It gets you to the lobbyists, so to speak. It gets you to the treasury itself. It gets you to the Valley of the Kings, which has become the treasury of this time period. And if you don't use the ideology to get there and you just smash and grab your way in, you will not be accepted in this system long term. It's not going to work. And so generals become high priests, and this is the way they do it. And then kings' bodies become tokens. They become talisman. They become kind of like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Oh, sorry, I said the whole thing because I'm an Egyptologist and the film title just rolls off the tongue. Kind of like the Ark of the Covenant. That's what I wanted to say. Being held aloft by the army, and then anything is possible, right?
Right.
In a way, we've got generals, warlords coming in, gaining ideological power, access to more power thereby, going into the Valley of the Kings, opening up tombs that are not easy to dismantle. We can talk about that, what that might have been. And then pulling out treasures, but also using the bodies at the center of the whole discussion, the dead, as a means of claiming they need to be in power because they're the only ones who can caretake. It's the same as any dictator does. Start a war and then say, I'm the only one who can fix it, and use all the ideology to maintain that power.
Well, and you very nicely, sort of a nice segue here, because you brought up the bodies of these ancestor kings and that act of reburying within the ancient Egyptian context. In your research, you've pointed out that the act of burying somebody actually entitles you to an inheritance, this idea of burial and inheritance. And so can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's no law code in ancient Egypt, which is kind of wild and crazy and gives you an idea of how much ad hoc decision-making there was at the top and how little competition there was. So you didn't even need a law code. People are like, we'll just do what's in my, you know, we'll just do what's fair. But there is this one law that is mentioned in, I, a 20th dynasty West Theban context in a will, and it is called the Law of the Pharaoh. And it says that the one who buries inherits. Very simple. You bury your parents or your aunt and uncle or whoever it is, you inherit. You spend the money on the tomb decoration, the coffins, the whole nesting set, the mummification, the wrappings. This is an elite game, right? Then you get the proceeds of that. You get the lands that the dead leave behind. You get their home. You get whatever it is. And this has, it allows whoever smashes and grabs their way almost to the top, then becomes high priest, to then go in and say, you know, all these robbers did all these horrible things. Look what they did to this tomb. Can blame it on others, can even create interrogations and public investigations that make it seem like other people are more responsible than they were. And then go in and say that they will fix it and be the ones that rewrap, reconsecrate, redivinize, re-osirify. That's the word that they use in the dockets that are put on these coffins. They're osirifying the dead. They're making them whole again. And they're the ones that do that. And thus they inherit the power. They inherit even the stuff. And hard times allow people to justify all kinds of things. Like if you and I were with somebody on a life raft and we were miles from sea and there's a third person on the boat and that third person dies, and then we will just, or maybe we kill that third person, but we justify it by saying, maybe we draw lots, Amber. We're on the boat, you know, let's draw lots. Is that, I think that's what we would do. And be like, okay, who's going to die to be eaten? And we would justify it by saying, well, two of us would live, you know, what's better, three dead people or two of us living? And people can justify all kinds of crazy shit in times of crisis. This is a time of crisis. The gold mines are shut down. The quarries are shut down. The warlords are abroad. So they go to the kings and they justify their recommodification as an inheritance by reburying and reossirifying and giving them ritual in exchange for things.
So people look at it and say, well, but you're taking this stuff, or, you know, why do you have all this stuff? You're supposed to be just simply reburying them. Like, well, yes, we're reburying them. And this is our inheritance. This is, they're justifying their ability to take and recommodify all of that material.
Yeah. And maybe giving the dead access as well. I mean, we don't have evidence of it. And these are the kinds of things that are not written down, these initiated acts. And if you've been a part of a cult or you've read Apuleius's Golden Ass, you get an idea that you only learn the top secret stuff. The higher up you go, the more initiated you are. And these things are not written down. They're only done in a secret fashion. But we can imagine them taking out kings like Ramses II or Thutmose III and these revered kings, right? Kings that everyone believes are awesome, kind of like George Washington or Jefferson, and pulling them out. And when they're reburied, bringing them into contact with Amun so they can unite with the god Amun in his shrine, bringing them to the temple, making them into divinities in a way that they had not been before. And though we don't have evidence for anything like that, thinking of a king being imbued with power as an icon is what the coffins seem to suggest they're doing.
Yeah. You mentioned Thutmose III there. Can we talk a little bit about him as a specific example, just to kind of narrow the focus a little bit?
Yeah. Thutmose III is an 18th dynasty king. He is often called the Napoleon of ancient Egypt because he went into Syria and Nubia and expanded Egypt's borders beyond anything they had been previously, and campaigned in the first 20 years of his life, like every year, something like that. And Thutmose III has a long reign. The first part of his reign he shares with Hatshepsut, who Pure takes for him. But he has an awesome reputation. He's there when Egypt is on the upswing. He's remembered quite fondly. His seventh pylon showing him smiting enemies of the northeast is beloved in the south. He's a Theban king, so the people of Thebes are going to really love him. And so he's a uniter. He's somebody that everyone can get behind. Unlike maybe Ramses II, who we can imagine unites most, but it's kind of more of a, I don't know, dare I say, Reagan kind of figure, where people are like, right? We're like, Reagan's awesome, people might say, and Reagan did this and that. But there's a lot of people, I just read on Twitter, it's like every bad thing in the United States can you know, it started with Reagan, which is kind of an awesome quote.
Well, that's a very blanket statement.
It is a blanket statement. But there's a tremendous number of Americans who revere Reagan in a divinized kind of way. But Ramses II, while he's the great, is more divisive. It's Thutmose III that everyone in Thebes really wants to get behind.
Well, Ramses II doesn't have Theban origins, right? So
no, he does not. He does
not.
So
that's Bear is perhaps reason enough for them to steer away from him and toward, as you say, the very solidly Theban Thutmose III.
Yeah. He's still in the royal cache. He's still put in a very nice coffin and redivinized in that way. But he's not ever painted, I don't think he's ever painted onto the backboard of a 21st dynasty coffin, for instance, whereas Thutmose III is. And Thutmose III is identified with the god Amun-Re the way Amenhotep I is identified with Amun-Re. And so Ramses II, I don't want to put down his legacy too much because it's a pretty strong legacy, but it is different from Thutmose III's for this particular space and time, for these Theban stakeholders in the 20th, 21st, early 22nd dynasties. And yeah, so that's where Thutmose III comes in. I don't know if there's any oracles of Thutmose III. I have to check. There might be. And it's something I should know, of course, from this time period. But the same time period that Thutmose III is being held up as a real icon of ancestor worship, you see people like Harry Hoar using his high priesthood to become king. And but a king of a different kind, such that he's making Amun-Re king of all the gods. So the true Theban king at this point, in many ways, for these high priests, is Amun-Re. It's the god Amun. And they're the caretakers for this king. So it's a time period in which it's more popular to even downplay kingship, which makes sense. When there's an administration previous that's been very destructive and hated by people, you don't want to identify with it. So there's some time periods where you want to be really strong in the way you take power, and other time periods where you pull back and you're like, I want to let people decide. And this seems to be one of those times when kingship is unpopular and it's downplayed for that reason. But a dead king like Thutmose III is different because he's considered a king of his people, a king on the battlefield, a king who hasn't been diminished in the way that the late Ramesside kings were remembered to have been in people's cultural memory.
Right. And as we know about history, you can't, once somebody is dead and gone, you can make their story what you will, especially if you are telling a story for political or ideological purposes. And so there's the cultural memory of Thutmose III that I think you're referencing here, but then there's also, I would assume there would have been some flexibility in what did they highlight? What things or aspects of this cultural memory of Thutmose III did they want to remind people of or bring to the forefront?
I mean, Amber, you've written on this. Like, think of whom we choose to divinize as leaders in the United States. Do they come from the beginnings of things or from the ends of things or from the middle of things? Like, what have you noticed there?
Well, if we're wanting to make a comparison within an American context, I think the easiest examples to go to would be, say, George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. Those are two figures that typically, across the political spectrum, you're going to find people that know that history for one, or at least the broad strokes of it, know these figures, and in a way, venerate them, right? And honor them and look at them as having laid the path for America today. And as I was mentioning to you earlier, it wasn't that long ago, I actually was on a family vacation and we went to Mount Vernon, where George Washington lived, and Monticello, which was Thomas Jefferson's home. And I always have your reuse, right, in the back of my head. And so walking through these spaces, and even just museums in general, these are spaces of reuse, right? You're taking something that was once the home of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, and it is being repurposed and recommodified in very concrete ways, and also used ideologically to bolster an American narrative. Now, different people coming away from these sites today might come away with different narratives, which is fascinating in and of itself. But I mean, just using that American example or putting it in the American context, hopefully that helps people to be able to think in those terms a little bit more and apply it to ancient Egypt and see these high priests of Amun using that in similar ways, right? Using that cultural memory and tradition.
Oh my God, Amber, I love the analogy, the comparison of the president's house with the coffin of Thutmose III.
Oh, there you go. That's awesome.
Because it's a container.
Right.
It's a container. It's something that you can visit.
That has a function.
It has a function. You can manipulate it. It held the body of the king or the president. I wonder sometimes if they fucking sold tickets for people that can't see the coffin of Thutmose III.
You would bring an offering, right? And what happens, just like at the temple, what happens to these offerings? We're talking about this cyclical kind of economic system. So yeah, I would say absolutely. Yeah, you can come and see offering.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be as boldly, you're exactly right. Of course you're right. It wouldn't be as boldly stated as you got to pay to see him. It would be, you must buy the indulgence. You must buy, you have to pay your way forward into the group. I'm like being a board member and they're like, we expect board members to have 100% participation. I didn't understand what that meant until it meant that I was supposed to give $10,000 to be on the board.
Well, and
my God.
when you go to these presidential homes, because I went to several of them, that ticket price that you pay, it's, this goes back into maintaining the grounds and maintaining this historical landmark. And of course, there's also some profit. I'm not going to say they're completely mercenary. I'm sure a lot of it does go to the purposes that they point out. But the point is there's still an exchange of something, right? You give something in order to get access to this venerated site or this honored place.
You know, this brings up exactly one point that I was making or trying to make at the ICE conference, which I don't know if it went over as well as I would like. It's a hard point to make, but there's a tomb, the Theban Tomb 65, Tomb of Yemi Seba, in which he mentions offerings being given to different Amun-Re temples and the Amun or different temples of the area. And there, some of them are like the Temple of Thutmose III, a mortuary temple, Temple of Medinet Habu, temple, different spaces. And there's even Valley of the Kings type spaces here. And this was a very rich man who had a tomb at the end of the 20th dynasty when no one had a tomb, a decorated tomb, chapel that you could enter into with your family on the Day of the Dead, beautiful Feast of the Valley, and hang out. This was somebody who was connected to the pulse of the economics of this 20th dynasty Theban place. And the offerings are really a sacralized and veiled economy that he is a part of, that he is helping to lead, but none of it is ever stated. It is all stated as offerings and connected to different temple installations. And that's the way we have to unravel it. If you can't understand American society unless you understand what a flyover at an NFL game means, or why you welcome the veteran home on the field and what that patriotism means, and you parse it out, like say you had somebody coming from a different country and they're like, what's going on here? And you have to explain it. And by explaining it, you might understand it better yourself, but it's something that's so inbred into us, we don't think about it. And looking at Egypt, we have to be like, wait, it's not just religion. Don't be stupid. Nothing's ever just religion. It's money, it's influence, it's power, it's society, it's all of these different things. And now that when I walk into Thomas Jefferson's house and I see his writing desk over by his bed, I mean, I'm just thinking coffin all the way, coffin reuse, baby. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to walk through some of those spaces and also to see people's reaction, in particular, Thomas Jefferson's Monticello is they're both complicated, you know, for many reasons. But Thomas Jefferson and his relationship with Sally Hemings hangs over the entire context of Monticello and also him as an historical figure. And I bring this up only to point out that, I mean, think of all the little complexities and the different struggles for power that must have been happening within the high priesthood of Amun within the late 20th into the 21st and 22nd dynasties that we're never going to be able to get at. But as you say, to just simply change your perspective and not take everything at face value and to see, oh, yes, this is an offering. You get the religious credit, you get the ideological credit, but you also get the power that comes with it, the influence that comes with being able to throw around that kind of money.
And, you know, fashions change. So now we're wokely, I just made that into an adverb. We are wokely looking at Thomas Jefferson in a way that we did not in, say, the 60s. So if you, or early 60s, perhaps, but say you went into Monticello in the early 60s, you would have a very different story of Thomas Jefferson told, in which Sally Hemings wasn't mentioned. Her age of, what is it, 13 or 14 when he started a sexual relationship with her isn't discussed. I mean, I know it's probably not discussed there now, but you might have at least a verbal conversation that touches upon it. So you have different fashions of what you're able to talk about, the enslavement of one's own children. You know, we might be able to talk about now, but certainly not in the early 60s. You would make it, it would be a very different story. And I can see the same kind of thing with the coffin of Thutmose III, for example. So the coffin of Thutmose III was taken out of its tomb. It's a high cliff tomb in the Valley of the Kings, one of those tombs that was meant to be more secret and not with the monumental gateway.
No one seeing, no one hearing.
Exactly. That's what we have for Thutmose I's tomb. And this coffin is one of many, right? It may not have been his. It seems to be an 18th dynasty coffin. It could be Thutmose I's coffin. It could be somebody else's originally. There's no inscription on the outside that would help us to understand it. There is an inscription on the inside, which given the mortise and tenons and modification of the coffin, has to be 21st dynasty. There's nothing else that it can be stratigraphically. It just has to be 21st dynasty. And they're even using an old 18th dynasty style of writing to put the name and titles of Thutmose III on the inside of that coffin. So they're trying to even hide what they're doing. But so they take that coffin out of that cliffside, the coffin set out of that cliffside tomb. It certainly had a sarcophagus of stone or many or more than one. It would have had shrines. Gilded shrines, we can imagine Tutankhamun's ensemble and maybe compare it. And maybe they reburied, they took a lot of the gilding from the shrines. They took a lot of the solid gold things from the tomb and they melted those down. And maybe they reconsecrated Thutmose III in a full nesting set. Or maybe he had an inner coffin of solid gold because this does seem to be an outer coffin. And they took that and melted that down and left him in two coffins. Took the gold sheeting off, but they re-gilded it. They must have put some precious gilding on there because 50 years later, they reopen the thing and they take that gilding off. Then it seems they re-gilded it again with a thinner variety of gilding. But so there's fashions changing. It's like, okay, at this time period, we're going to worship him in such a way so that he gets two coffins with a nice thick gilding. And then it's, no, we can't do this anymore. We need the money, number one. Number two, you know, we think about Thutmose III in a slightly different way. We're going to give him a thinner layer of gilding. We're going to remove all of this other stuff and consecrate him again in a different way. But his coffin shows that it was opened and closed, opened at least twice and modified at least twice, and then closed after each of these openings. And then there was a final hacking of the piece, probably when it was put into the royal cache of Theban tomb 320, though there's disagreement there. And that rough hacking just gets that final layer of gilding. But it gives you an idea that there are decisions made about how this coffin and this king on the inside should be displayed, what he gets versus what the living get to take from him. And all of these different negotiations are at the same time sacralized so that the high priests of Amun, who are different from Pai Yonk and Herihor at this time, they'll be like Pinedjem II. They're still using this token, this talisman, this divine ancestor cult statue, if you like, to justify their own rule. They're not calling themselves king anymore by this time, Pnejim II and some of the other high priests. They are caretakers only, priests only. And even that fashion changes, right? So there's just a great deal of change that is visible within that one coffin of Thutmose III, where you can see multiple mortises being sunk for new tenons when another tenon is sawn through, and then more stuff being taken. So that the coffin is, the side walls are so thin by the end, that final hacking breaks through the thickness of the surface and you get these open holes in it. So it's such a cool,
amazing.
Piece.
So what you're saying is, so again, we'll make a little bit of a comparison here. So it's sort of like looking at the physical evidence of, say, the changing perceptions of Thomas Jefferson, right? You've got the 60s mm-hmm. perception in which maybe he's given a lot more respect and treated as a much more venerated figure. And then you've got, say, the 2024 perspective, which would be different, right? Much more critical. It just, he's going to be seen in a different way because time has passed. There's different cultural context and he's not seen in quite the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've divinized Hamilton now, right? The immigrant who gets the job done and the finance.
Have we divinized Hamilton or Lin-Manuel Miranda?
I don't know, but I see when I went to New York when Hamilton was really playing, you could see that. And when did it come out? Like
was it 2019? No, I think it was early. Like Hamilton itself.
Yeah.
I think it was earlier. I think it might have been 2017, maybe even earlier. I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
But he's a perfect tech bro, finance bro, divinization. I mean, and this northerner or a person who claimed the North obviously comes from the West Indies, but like, it's a new non-slaveholding abolitionist finance Bank of America kind of lobbyist kind of God versus the plantation owner, which is both Jefferson and Washington, both of them Virginians, both of them enslavers. And we're still looking for new models of the beginnings of America. It's pretty crazy.
Right. Okay, Kara. So let's kind of wrap things up here. And let me ask you, why did they put these kings away in these caches?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, right? If these are like the divinized ancestors and you need them to get your power, why would any ruler of Thebes then put them away into this cache space, hack off any remaining gold really roughly, and be like, screw you, Thutmose III, get ye in your hole? Why would anyone do that and why would it serve them? And that's something I go into more detail about in the forthcoming book, Recycling for Death, because it's a tough one, but there's another regime change. And what was once done is now unfashionable. So the 21st dynasty high priesthood and how they created an ideological economy of power using these kings, taking all of the shit from the Valley of the Kings, is seen in a problematic light by the 22nd dynasty men who come in and take over the high priesthood. So the new high priesthood of Amun, which is connected to the 22nd dynasty Tanite kings, Shawshank, Orser Khan, they want to differentiate themselves from what has come before. And they don't want to be associated with this, what may be perceived as a kind of faux caretaking. politically using these kings and saying, oh, we would never use these kings in this way. We are these kings. And instead of using Thutmose III to set yourself up as a priestly ancestor, you get Shawshank I putting himself up very much like Thutmose III, as Thutmose III, parallel to him at the Bubastite portal at Karnak Temple. So, and he's copying Thutmose III when he does this. So in this new regime, this 22nd dynasty regime coming in is like, no, we're going to do it different this way. We're going to set ourselves up as the ancestor kings ourselves. We are not going to use them as tokens and talismans. We are them. And so they don't need them around anymore. In fact, it's problematic to have them around anymore. Kind of like they one-up them. So they put Thutmose III and all the other guys away. And you don't see those kinds of oracles to the kings. You still see the oracles to divinities, but even less so. You don't have those recorded in the 22nd dynasty the same way you did in the 21st. And they change as well. yes, Thebes is still a city where Amun-Re is king of the gods and the most important king. And yes, you still have oracles. And yes, you still have all of these religious ways to veil power, but you're not using the 18th dynasty ancestor kings in the same way and using their bodies as a way to justify power. I would also suggest that it's because the treasures in the Valley of the Kings have been depleted. They've been used up. They're gone. There's nothing left.
That was just what I was thinking. So, I was like, the bank account is running dry and it's becoming impractical, right?
Yeah.
I would assume after you've harvested so much from, say, the coffin of Thutmose III, for example, it's kind of, okay, that's all we can get out of it. There's nothing more that we can pull.
Yeah. It's like even the dead have diminishing resources, even those systems that rely on them. They're depleted. And so Thutmose III himself ideologically has no more to give. And they put him away. And yes, he's come back out again, I suppose, in recent times to be discussed. And maybe if we went out and talked to somebody who said who Thutmose III is, maybe get an answer. Somebody who knows their history is certainly going to know who Thutmose III is. And in the late period, he's resuscitated as well. It's all kinds of scarabs with the name of Thutmose III. And at Medinet-Habu, they have the chapel of the Ogdoad, the small temple at Medinet-Habu, is redone in the Ptolemaic period. So there's still Thutmose III interest, but not like this, not like this. And the 22nd dynasty guys need to differentiate themselves from that. So he and all the other kings, the second Enri Taos, the Ahmes Nefertari, they need to be put away.
Yeah, it's
whatever
a bit of
was being
ideological
done
with reset.
Them, we don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And oh, and one final point. One final point, which is what was my final point? I forgot. One more reset. Oh, I'm sorry. The queens, the king. I can't remember what it is. It's fine. Let it go. It's all good. So yes, 22nd dynasty. I can't remember what it was. Shit. It's fine. It's good. It's all good.
It happens. It'll come to you at about...
Wait,
oh, you
remember.
What is
I remember.
It? What is it?
I remember. Okay, so then the final point is that we're leaving a time period in which exclusive inward display to a very small audience of stakeholders was working. We're leaving that behind of the 21st dynasty, moving into the 22nd dynasty system in which you needed to make a much bigger public splash. You needed to get more people involved. And so these more carefully orchestrated displays for only the initiated, they're not going to work in the 22nd dynasty. And that's when these coffin displays and re-coffining and re-osirifications under the gaze of a bunch of priests, that's going to go away into a different kind of royal display that depends on Amun-Re as the king of this Theban place.
Right. So this ideological change is both religious or ideological, but also practical. So there are different factors at play, and the two kind of came together, and you have a different perspective, a different approach to things come the 22nd dynasty, you said?
Early 22nd dynasty, you get this big shift and they're all cashed and put away at that moment.
Well, I don't know about the listeners, but I enjoyed this discussion. I hope they were able to follow us on some of these twists and turns of the complicated and tumultuous history of the late 20th into the 21st dynasty.
Yeah, it's super fun stuff. It's the gift that keeps on giving to me. It's complicated, as I forget a little point here or there, but it's really cool. And I'll be writing my next popular book on this time period as well. So that's fun.
Yeah, well, we look forward to that. So get right.
Don't we, Jess?
Well, great. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And this is
Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week, and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for at Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.